Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good afternoon and welcome to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And on the phone with me today is Janet Riley. Janet is the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Professional Development for the American Meat Institute. In her role, she develops public information and issue management strategies. She manages the press relations and drafts speeches, news releases, and other public communications, as well as overseeing the Institute's news reporting on meatami.com. She oversees the AMI's Member Services Department as well. And in addition, she is the liaison to the Animal Welfare Committee and oversees policy initiatives in this area. Welcome to the show, Janet. Thanks so much for joining me today and taking time out of your busy day.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Well, as you know, we have committed to making some headway in the sort of polarization of relations between the meat industry and the progressive earthy crunchies like me. And this is our first step towards that goal. So tell us first, what is the American Meat Institute and what do you guys do?
Sure. We're the oldest and largest trade association that represents the meat industry. And so we are your classic trade association. We provide government relations representation on the Hill and with the regulatory agencies. We talk to media. We run a scientific foundation that does a lot of food safety research and nutrition projects. And we run a convention, and we do a lot of education for our members.
Fantastic. Actually, I want to come to that convention, so I'll have to look on your website and see where that is. Now, you recently collaborated on a new video on pork processing with Temple Grandin, and that was number two in a series that you intend to produce. I think there's one more in the pipeline for poultry, right?
That's right.
And you did the first one on cattle processing. So can you tell us, take us behind the scenes and explain why you decided to make these, because obviously they're not cheap to make, and what do you hope to achieve through releasing these videos?
It's interesting. You know, it's no secret that Americans are more removed from the farm, and certainly from the slaughter process. It's not something that most Americans have seen today. And so we became concerned that there were some misconceptions, and then with the advent of undercover video technology, people were telling our story for us when bad things happen, as opposed to the many days when everything goes right. And so over time we decided, you know, it might make some sense to actually show the process and educate the public. But we felt like we needed to do it in a very credible way and with a leading expert. And in this area, there's nobody better than Temple Grandin, and she's been our partner on our animal welfare efforts since 1991. And she was thrilled because she had wanted to see more transparency. She was delighted to host the videos, and so she chose two plants. They're not named, but she chose two plants that she felt were representative, and we asked them, would you let us in with Dr. Grandin? And they said, yes, no problem. And so we've made two videos that have been incredibly well-received.
How can people access those videos if they're consumers at home?
We have a dedicated website called animalhandling.org. Mm-hmm. And right on the front page, you'll see a reference to our Glass Walls project. And so there's a beef video, a pork video, and there's also a print brochure that contains images from the videos that has more text that explains all the steps in the process. And these are not sanitized videos. You saw the video, Katie, and
yeah.
I mean, I think you'll agree. These really just show it like it is. We don't attempt to sugarcoat the process. It's a process that is quite remarkable when you've never seen it, because we're accustomed to seeing something put together. We're accustomed to seeing a car put together.
Right.
We're not accustomed to seeing something disassembled. And it's quite complicated, and it's a living, breathing animal that deserves respect and humane treatment. It's quite complicated, and most people are truly fascinated by the process when they see it.
If you can get past watching stunned pigs rolling off a conveyor belt. I mean, I have to say that with all of my experience in butchering and even being in a slaughter plant for cattle, that one really sort of floored me. But as you say, it's important to see what the process is, and that by and large, it's pretty successful at doing what it needs to do most efficiently and theoretically without any pain to the animals. But why do you think it is, Janet, that processors continue to get busted by animal welfare groups for abuse? I mean, even in the last year or so, there have been a number of like the Butterball Turkey video that came out that showed workers kicking and beating turkeys and stuff like that. Why does that keep happening, even when you guys are working so hard to make sure that animals are treated correctly by your workers? What's going on there?
Well, I think that those kinds of videos are incredibly upsetting to the viewer, and they're certainly upsetting to us when you see something go wrong like that, because that is not how we want to treat livestock, and poultry. There's no reason to treat them in any way other than the most humane way possible, because it's ethically appropriate and it even creates a better quality finished product. There's just so many good reasons to do the right thing.
Let's talk for one second about that finished product, because I think people should understand that when animals are stressed or abused, their meat isn't as good. So there's even a financial incentive for plants to make sure that their workers are handling animals correctly. And that's why I find it so surprising that it isn't, that it is possible to catch you guys with your pants down, as it were.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, to be fair, I think that in any industry you're in any, whether it's healthcare, whether it's, you know, meat or poultry processing, whether it's auto manufacturing, unfortunately, there are, it involves people, and sometimes people don't always behave in the way that they should, and that's unfortunate. But I think what we don't get to see, you know, we talk about null results in research when you don't find anything, and sometimes, like, you're looking for a relationship between a disease and a food, and often when there's no relationship, they don't get published. Well, the same goes for undercover videos. If somebody goes into a plant and finds good practices, they don't release the video and say, we sent an undercover researcher in here or an undercover videographer in here, and we didn't find anything.
Right, that's
and I'm quite confident that happens, but you don't hear that. And that's why the videos we've released show what a plant looks like when it's operating as it should.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to imagine how problems could occur when you consider the level of oversight that we have. There is no other segment of animal agriculture that has the kind of federal inspection that we do. Our inspectors are in during every minute of operation, not just stopping by on a, you know, this is every minute of operation if you're in a plant that slaughters live animals. And in our largest plants, we probably have about a dozen inspectors per shift. So there are lots of federal inspectors, which is really good, because they help ensure that the processes are working as they should, and they have the power to stop the lines if there's any kind of an issue, and they do stop the lines when there are problems.
Did you, by any chance, read Ted Conover's, speaking of somebody who did see it working more or less correctly, did you read his lead? He had the cover story in Harper's this month.
Oh, I sure did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there may have been things that the industry didn't like about what he said, but boy, you know, he didn't report any abuse, and it was all very sort of cozy and comfy amongst the workers. I was kind of amazed, because it was a real contrast, for example, to Timothy Potcherot's book, Every 12 Seconds, which detailed a lot of reluctance to stop the line because of the financial implications of stopping a production line for any amount of time in order to correct abuses of one kind or another, whether it's food safety and handling or whether it's actual animal abuse. I think that there's a lot of disincentives for people to not call out problems when they see them. Do you not think that's a problem occasionally, at least?
Well, first of all, I thought Ted Conover, I thought that was what was really remarkable about his piece, was that, you know, it did show things working pretty much as they should, for the most part. It's interesting, the issue of stopping the line. inspectors have to make big judgment calls. When they look at an issue, they have to decide, is something an anomaly in a plant? Is something that just happened, like a stunner misfired? Is that just an anomaly? And, you know, if you quickly swap out a new stun gun and you ensure that it's working properly, you can continue to process without a risk of it happening again. That's typically what they want to do, because you've got livestock coming in on trucks. And it's quite, when you consider the logistics of bringing in livestock and poultry into plants, you want to keep that flow going if you can. Certainly, if there's a practice that would pose a risk to other incoming animals, they need to stop the line or take some action to make sure it doesn't happen again. But they also have to look at the bigger picture, because particularly pigs, for example, on a very hot day, if they get backed up on trucks because they're en route to the plant, suddenly the plant's not operating, that can actually cause a bigger welfare problem. So they have to look at the big picture and make the decision about what's best for the greatest number of livestock.
That's an interesting point to bring up. So when we talk about animal welfare, and I know that this is near and dear to your heart, what do you see is the next level of animal welfare? What can your group or any other trade group associated with the industry do to encourage plants and producers, especially, to take animal welfare to another level, where these kinds of videos that you guys have unfortunately been subject to over and over again, where there just isn't, as you say, there just is nothing but null results. In other words, nobody's going to catch you doing something that you shouldn't. What's the next step, do you think, in terms of that? What about the third-party audited video stream, for example, that Temple Grandin is so keen on?
Sure. I don't think there's one silver bullet, but I think there's a couple of things that will continue to improve welfare. One of the things we've been doing with Dr. Grandin is really striving to professionalize the role of animal handler in the meatpacking plant. I mean, these jobs are critical. Someone who's unloading pigs, it may not sound like a big glamorous job to someone who's never done it, but it is a really important job. Someone who's stunning pigs or cattle or any animal, doing it accurately, it is absolutely critical to the welfare of the animal. So we've been trying to really recognize the importance of that by providing education. We launched a conference with Dr. Grandin. Our first one was in 1999, and every year more than 300 people come to Kansas City to be trained by her to ensure that they're up to speed on practices and equipment. It's quite amazing to watch people from the line interacting with her and asking their questions, or what do I do in this particular situation? So we've been really trying to pull those people in and just sending them on a business trip and recognizing the importance of that role goes a long way.
Are you able to screen your candidates for animal handling? I mean, I know one thing Temple told me is that 10% of the people who work in animal handling should never be allowed near an animal, and that goes for supervisors too. So are you guys making steps to screen better for the people who are involved with animal handling?
There has been a movement in the industry to, what are the factors? What are the personalities that will work well in those areas? Mm-hmm. We're just about to go out with a survey of our members, and we're actually going to ask that question. What are you doing to ensure that you're hiring the right person for these jobs? And we're going to ask them about things like that. Do they have to have experience working with livestock? Do they have to, are their personality just, what steps are you taking? So in another month or so, I'll know better what the industry is doing. But I feel quite confident that they recognize the importance of getting the right people in those jobs, because it's absolutely critical. But even videos like the ones that we just put out, they actually are educational for other members of the industry. Maybe they've only worked in one plant. They've never seen another plant. It's good for them to see these kinds of things and to hear Dr. Grandin talk about the steps. But you asked about video auditing.
Yeah.
And video auditing is playing a bigger and bigger role. There's a couple of different types of, we use video in different ways. Some plants have video that broadcasts within the plant. So maybe a plant manager is watching it. Other plants have feeds that go to an auditing company. So they're using the audit that we developed with Dr. Grandin in 1997, and they're actually auditing remotely, looking at various aspects of the plant. So they might be looking at how many livestock fall when they're walking at a certain point, how many animals are stunned perfectly the first time, you know, different aspects of welfare. And then if they see a problem, they alert the plant, but they're constantly providing data. And they can even look at, you know, how different personnel are functioning and what's their performance like. And so that's been really, really useful. It's not an inexpensive system, so it may not be feasible for every size company, because it would require a big capital investment for a small company.
Really?
Very high-tech system.
Video cameras are cheap.
I'm talking about the remote auditing system.
Oh, I see. Like using something like Aerosite, that company that Temple is.
Right. That could be tough for a small company, but more and more companies are installing, you know, their own video systems within the plants.
Well, why wouldn't trade associations participate in funding that? Isn't that what some of these trade associations are kind of for? Is for, you know, organizing some sort of funding for? I mean, you certainly help out with crisis management. Why wouldn't a trade association also help out with funding something like this?
That's really not what a trade association does. We do more research, and we provide information, and we host conventions where they will exhibit and give them the opportunity to interact with those companies.
I see.
But we don't typically fund something that would be deployed in a plant. But in terms of the question that comes up is this live feed idea. And some people said, oh, just make a live feed and broadcast it to the internet and show everybody what's happening in every plant. Couple of issues there. First of all, we have unionized federal inspectors. And I think it is highly unlikely that they would ever agree to being broadcast live on the internet. That would be a big deal. So I think that the inspection workforce probably would object to that. We cannot even photograph an inspector in a plant without prior permission.
Huh.
So you won't see inspectors typically on the videos that we show, because we would have to get all sorts of permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But the other issue I have is, if I watched something I didn't understand, like if I had a live feed from an operating room, for example, and nobody was explaining to me what was happening, I would have no idea what I was looking at. Is this good surgery? Is this bad surgery? What are they doing? I don't know. That's why we decided that taking the approach we did with Dr. Grandin, where she actually explains it and puts some context around it, was probably more useful to people.
Well, I can't say I disagree with that, but I still think that having that video stream, whether you show inspectors or not, and whether or not people are even aware of exactly what the steps are, once theoretically they view all of your videos, they'll have a better idea of what to expect. But what do you think is the reason there's so much pushback within the industry against a video stream, whether it's audited by a third party or simply sent to, say, you know, Cargill headquarters? I mean, I've heard a lot of guys in the industry, Raoul Baxter, Dr. You know, like a lot of those guys that blog on Meeting Place are also very much against the idea of the video stream. Is it simply because of the anonymity of the inspectors, or what other issues do you see?
I'm not familiar with. I did not realize they'd made comments about it, so I'm not familiar with their specific comments on it. But I don't sense a pushback at all in the industry.
Really?
No, I sense a real embrace of video. And when I go to plants, I see it more and more. I'm in plants all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it's definitely something that's coming online, whether it's within the plant broadcast or into the manager's office, or whether it's remotely audited by a third-party firm.
Right. I certainly got that impression at the convention that I went to, the Animal Agriculture Alliance. I heard a lot of people talking about, yes, let's bring that into the plant and let's make that universal. So, I mean, I have to say that I do feel sort of encouraged about that. Janet, I hate to say this, but we have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. But please, folks, stay tuned to my conversation with Janet Riley, the Communications Director for the American Meat Institute. We'll be right back.
This one's called Broke Down by the California Honey Drops, and you are listening to What Doesn't Kill You on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Get nowhere until you know what for. you're pulling, you get there by and by.
We're back with Ms. Janet Riley, the vice president, and let me just read your little thing here. This is vice president of senior vice president of public affairs and professional development for the American Meat Institute, and we're talking about the meat industry and how they relate to all the various challenges that they face in the 21st century. Not the least of which is a lot of consumer distrust, and that's what this conversation is all about: is to try to bring some kind of reality check to consumers so that they understand some of the processes that go on in the meat industry, whether or not you want to eat meat. The point is to recognize that the industry is doing, I think, its best to come online with some of the things that consumers are most concerned about. And so to that end, Janet, my next question to you is, what do you feel are the greatest challenges that face the livestock industry today in terms of reassuring consumers that you guys are doing the best you can to do your job correctly?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's been a bit of romanticization of the way we used to do things.
Yes.
And that poses some issues for us because people have an idea that if it's small and if it's local, it's automatically safer and it's automatically more humane. And that may not be the case. Small and local plants can produce safe and humane products. They can also have problems, and the same goes for large plants. But I think that movies like Food, Inc., unfortunately, have created a bit of an inaccurate picture of how we operate and what we're all about. And now we're playing catch-up. So I blame ourselves to some extent, and me personally, because I'm supposed to be the communicator for the industry, for perhaps not talking more vociferously or more openly, but we're definitely committed to it now. And so because I just think there are a lot of myths that we have to overcome at mm-hmm. this point.
I think so, too. For example, let's bring up the issue of the environmental programs that mm-hmm. some meatpacking industry entities have instituted. I wouldn't say that it's universal, and I certainly think that there's a long way to go. But, you know, a lot of the charges leveled at the processing, meat processing, the meat industry, is the level of pollution that it brings, both in wastewater, in solid waste, and in methane. And I happen to know personally that some plants, especially the ones with the big bucks like Cargill, have put in some really sophisticated waste treatment plants. And I wondered if you would talk a little bit about some of the things that are being done within the industry that address these consumer concerns.
Sure. There are a wide array of programs like water reuse programs, energy reduction efforts, wastewater treatment on site, all sorts of initiatives that are, you know, not even new, that have been well established for the two decades that I've been in the industry, but they've been becoming more widespread. We're actually going out also with a survey on what our members' environmental practices are to try to capture some of those numbers so we can give more hard data. But, I mean, all these plants are regulated by EPA and by state and local officials, and they have to comply with a host of regulations. So I think that in that area, sustainability has become a bigger and bigger issue. It's a customer expectation from the retail stores and the food service operators that purchase our product and from the consumers themselves. And mm-hmm. so,
but when you say the EPA can regulate, I mean, recently, I think it was North Carolina is trying to regulate through agricultural, or rather farm protection bills, otherwise known as ag gag laws, trying to regulate how many times the EPA can fly over a wastewater lagoon. I mean, that doesn't seem like it's particularly consumer or environmentally friendly. Why do you think that there is that kind of, shall we say, pushback on the idea of being inspected, certainly by a government agency like the EPA?
I apologize. I'm not familiar with that situation. I think that's probably an on-farm issue, mm-hmm. maybe.
Quite possibly.
I just don't know the answer to that particular question.
Right, that's okay.
But again, you know, it's very interesting. I just heard Dr. Frank Mitlener speak at the Institute of Medicine the week mm-hmm. before last in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, another myth that we've heard has been that somehow more efficient meat production is more environmentally risky. And Dr. Mitlener challenged that assumption, and he especially challenged some of the United Nations data that's often cited. There's a statistic that people frequently use that livestock production causes more environmental damage than autos. and transportation. And Dr. Mintlehner argued that that's actually not the case. And now the United Nations admitted that actually that data was not accurate. And so he's leading a new effort to recalculate those numbers. And I heard his presentation in Washington, and it was absolutely fascinating. He says we're not even close, that transportation and energy production are far greater contributors. He also presented some data saying that efficient agriculture, the more efficient you are, the fewer resources you use. So unfortunately, some of the common refrains may be actually quite opposite of what the data will show. He was explaining, for example, in his presentation that it takes 5 cows in other countries to produce the same amount of milk that 1 cow would produce in California, for example. And when you're able to produce milk more efficiently, you have less of an environmental impact. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of data in his presentation that was absolutely fascinating. It just wasn't what you've been hearing.
Right. Where could people access, like, for instance, me? Where could I, what is his name again? Tell me again, Mintlehner?
Mintlehner, it's a Lehner? German name, yes. Huh? And it's very interesting. We actually videotaped him afterwards. We had a camera there, and we videotaped him, and we're going to post it because it was so good that it was such interesting information that he agreed to just sort of recite it for us on camera.
So we'll be able to access that on your American Meat Institute.
Absolutely, but you can find, if you search his name, mm-hmm. And it's a complicated spelling, but it's he's widely quoted, and his data should be published on the Institute of Medicine website as well, because he made a PowerPoint there.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Unfortunately, we have to close in just a minute or two, and I just want to bring up one last thing, which I know you and I have talked about, and I've even written about it for the Huffington Post, and that is the level of polarity between the two sides. And I put that quote up from your president saying, if you are already a member, I say thank you. If you are not, please consider joining our institute. Now more than ever, the industry must stand together. I mean, that indicates to me a sort of level of paranoia that I'm not sure is completely warranted. Do you feel like that is a sort of prevalent or prevailing sentiment within your industry and something that you would like to address? Or do you think it's completely justified to feel that way?
Well, I think that what he was speaking about were the increasing challenges we face. And mm-hmm. certainly we do feel that there have been some cases where we perhaps haven't gotten a fair shake from the media or from films like Food, Inc. But what he was referring to there is that the challenges are huge. I mean, we've got food safety challenges. Yeah. We've got animal welfare challenges. We need to be collaborating. So I don't think he intended to give off any kind of paranoid message.
You might bring that up with him.
You may have interpreted it. But there's just, it's a recognition that we need to be collaborating and sharing good ideas. One of the big initiatives he's led is to make issues non-competitive. And we made animal welfare non-competitive in 2002. We made food safety non-competitive in the late 90s. And what that means is that we need to stand together and share information. So if you found a way to destroy a pathogen in your plant, don't keep it a secret. Share it with everybody else. And if you've got a great new tool for handling livestock in a low-stress way and you're a member of the American Meat Institute, then you're pretty much obligated to share that with others.
Right.
So that everybody can benefit, because the better we are as an industry, everyone benefits.
Yeah.
You know, when there's a black eye, because if somebody has a problem, if there's an undercover video that comes out of one plant, it makes us all look bad.
I agree.
And so we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help everybody in the industry be the best that they possibly can be.
Right.
And Dr. Grandin has been an absolute godsend to us. We didn't get much of an opportunity to chat about the things that she's done. We were the first ones to partner with her and say, can you write us guidelines? And she wrote them in 1991 when she was a new professor. And then she wrote an audit for us in 1999. We've done similar things on the food safety front. And so we really do try to be proactive, because producing safe food, producing nutritious food, caring for livestock, and preventing problems is the best way to succeed as an industry.
I couldn't agree with you more. I want to thank you again, Janet Riley from the American Meat Institute, for joining me today. And I want you to tell us one more time where the people can access those excellent videos that you've produced with Temple Grandin that show the actual process of slaughtering both cattle and pork. Those are our not on your website. They are on animalhandling.org. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's our dedicated animal welfare website.
Okay.
So animalhandling.org. Or if you Google Temple Grandin and slaughter, the videos will come right up.
That sounds great. Thanks again, Janet, for joining me. And thank you to my sponsor. Thanks to my engineer, Jack Inslee, and we'll see you next week. Remember, go to our website, sign up, and pledge your membership to the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.